Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. It's been 1 year since a ransomware attack crippled the city of Columbus's operations, exposing thousands of residents' personal information, such as driver's licenses, social security numbers, and addresses in the process. City Council voted recently to spend $23 million to guard against future threats. Here to tell us more is WOSU News reporter George Shilcock, who's been covering the story. Welcome back to All Sides, George.
Glad to be back.
So the city and the FBI are still investigating the cyber attack. It happened a year ago. The city was not exactly forthcoming as the attack was unfolding. Do we know more now about what actually happened a year ago and why?
We definitely know a little bit more. Like you said, the city wasn't very, they didn't tell us a lot in the initial days after the attack. At first, they also tried to say, hey, none of the data online is usable. And then eventually the news media all found out, yes, there was social security numbers on the dark web. There was addresses, people's driver's licenses. Since then, they have held a couple of hearings at City Council where the Department of Technology, the city's basically IT department's director, has given updates as to what they know about the cyber attack. But really, since then, it's been kind of quiet. And we've been waiting on this report that the City Council says is forthcoming, giving more details about the attack.
But we were saying the FBI is involved. So do they think some criminal activity happened with this attack?
The FBI sent me a one-sentence email. They don't want to say much. They're still investigating. That's typical for law enforcement, to be fair to them. But yeah, everything from the city all the way up to the FBI is looking into this cyber attack, like I think they do with most cities. A lot of cities, a lot of public entities, universities experience cyber attacks, but the FBI is involved with Columbus's too.
And there are also two class action lawsuits that have been filed related to this. Who's suing who here?
Well, two lawsuits suing the cities. One is primarily just public employees, firefighters, and police officers. And then the other is broader to citizens of Columbus and can include more citizens and everyday people whose data may have been leaked online.
And what are they hoping to get back? Just some money?
hoping to get money, hoping city takes responsibility. A lot of these people claim that they experienced harm to their credit, harm to their finances, and other things because this very sensitive personal data was leaked online. There's also even names of undercover police officers. The class action with the police officers is John Doe's, and some of those may include undercover officers who were put under threat because of this.
Now, it took cybersecurity expert David Ross using his alias Connor Goodwolf to inform city residents that their personal information was actually leaked. But the city soon shut him down. Can you remind us what happened there?
Yeah, so Connor, David, he was basically telling news media for a week and a half. Started with NBC4. Eventually, we got in contact with him, showing us what was on the dark web exactly, showing us, hey, look, there are social security numbers of people on there. Hey, if you ever walked into City Hall, they scan your driver's license. Mm-hmm. Your driver's license may be online. I believe a couple of our reporters were included in that. And just everything of the like. And eventually the city said, no, we're going to stop this with a temporary restraining order. And that basically told Connor he cannot talk to us and he cannot talk to us anymore. Eventually he came to an agreement with the city where he can talk to us now, but he cannot show anyone or reveal to anyone what is on the dark web. That is the agreement, mutual agreed upon, that he came to the city where he can't show people personal information, but he could still talk about it and say, I found this online, I found that online, what he was originally doing.
Now, you interviewed a Columbus resident named Will Klatt, who he believes his personal information was leaked because of the cyber attack, and it led to some real headaches for him. What happened there?
Yeah, so Will told me that he found out that basically banks were contacting him saying, hey, did you open up a credit card? Hey, did you open up a credit card? He didn't. And he found out through some sleuthing that they had his driver's license photo. They had other information as well that that was found online, but they had his driver's license photo. And he connected that to visiting City Hall, often going there to advocate on behalf of issues and talk before City Council. Mm. And he eventually found this out, and that's how he connected it to the cyber attack. And his credit score dropped because of this. He says that he had a perfect credit score before this, and it has since dropped. Which is not good for someone like him. He's a property owner in Columbus, and that has affected his ability to do business as well.
Now, the city did take some steps to try to rectify the situation for residents who had their personal information leaked. So did someone like Will, did he sign up for the city's free credit monitoring?
Will, I actually didn't ask him if he did, but I know I did personally.
I live in the city too. I did too. Yeah.
This was the Experian credit monitoring that I believe it's still active today. It'll give you an alert should your social security number, like your other data, be used essentially. And it cost the city over $1 million to give this to about 15,000 residents who signed up for it. Obviously,
15,000 is not a lot.
Not a lot. But
you and I are two of the 15,000.
But they did still offer it to people, and that was something that 15,000 isn't a small amount, but compared to the whole city, it is not a lot.
Yeah.
And the amount of people whose data was found online as well.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with WOSU's George Shilcock about the City of Columbus data breach from about a year ago and how the city plans to guard against future attacks. So the City Council voted last month to spend $23 million to install what is called the Zero Trust Network. What is it and how is it supposed to help?
Sounds fancy, right?
Yeah, Zero Trust Network.
So essentially, what a Zero Trust Network, to my understanding, in my reporting, is that essentially it does what it says. It doesn't trust people, even its own users. Like, say we're here on Ohio State University's system. If I'm trying to access a system, whether it be an email, whether it be an internal document, whether it be a computer drive of some sort, it will verify you every step of the way. It'll verify you by location. It'll have like the normal two-factor authentication type stuff, but it basically doesn't trust you. And it wants you to verify, and it checks on different data associated with where
you're logging. So even if you work there and you log in every day, it doesn't trust you every day.
Exactly.
Okay.
It has some more features as well, but essentially that's the gist of it. And the city is hoping to install this, and it'll be a way to prevent some cyber attacks in the future, not all. But one key thing about this is if a hacker does gain access to one system, the city and the Zero Trust Network is going to segment all the departments. So if they gain access to one, unlike the last cyber attack, they can't gain access to every single other department and take down the whole city systems.
We invited the Columbus technology chief, Sam Orth, on the show today. He was not able to join. T.R. Massey, director of communications for the city, sent an email that read in part, federal, state, and local governmental entities, including the City of Columbus, face persistent and sophisticated cybersecurity threats. And then I'm summarizing here. The Zero Trust Network assumes that the threats can exist both inside and outside the network, and therefore, among other things, the Zero Trust Network requires strict verification for every use. But basically, the city is saying it's not just us. You know, we were a big news story, but everyone, federal, state, and local governments are all open to these attacks, and we all need to just do a better job, right?
Which is true. Cyber attacks happen every week, every day. Like, systems are being attacked by these hackers a lot, whether they're from inside the country or even outside the country. I believe this entity was believed to be, RCETA is believed to be an overseas group. Mm-hmm. But one thing I think the city didn't mention is that this technology, Zero Trust Network, has been used for a while. Like, Connor told me he's been using this since the early 2000s.
Oh, so the city's behind.
I don't know. I don't know compared to other cities, essentially, because this is a lot of money that they're spending on this. Mm-hmm. But a lot of entities have been using this system for a while. It's existed for a while. And in my own research, I saw it really became popular starting in the late 2010s.
Okay. So perhaps this is something the city should have already had.
Perhaps, but perhaps. Hindsight is 20/20, right.
I know. But basically now the city is assuming everything is a potential threat. So it's a shift in security mindset from the city. That's basically what their email to us said. They're shifting their security mindset. Not that you're a cybersecurity expert, but do you think it'll work?
It's a great question. I did ask Connor, the whistleblower, and Connor said that he thinks for this specific cyber attack, the one that happened last year, no.
Oh.
That this wouldn't have worked because of the way that they got into this, which is he believes that it was a single person who basically got access to basically caused this to happen.
Like a single person allowed them in?
Essentially, yes. Mm. Whether by clicking a bad link, we don't really know yet. Mm. Of course, we still don't know who Patient Zero is. But for a lot of other attacks and threats, this does help. And it's why he uses it. Like, this is something that helps.
That's what I was going to ask you. Connor Goodwolf, is he appeased by this $23 million the city is spending?
No. Okay. Connor has a lot to say about this, and he has a lot of other suggestions for what the city needs to do. He is particularly critical of the Department of Technology and their staff, and he wants the city to do an overhaul of their department and hire actual experts, people who actually know the field of cybersecurity, and pay them better so that they can actually attract talent, in his view.
Now, the city has had a considerable amount of turnover in its technology department. Is it related or is it a coincidence? Is it related to this?
What I found was no. So we submitted public records requests for first every single employee who left, whether by resigning, retiring, or being fired from the Department of Technology since the cyber attack. And while they do have a significant number of employees, I believe over 100 in that department, there were 8 that left. And we did, there were a mix of reasons, resigning, retiring because they've been there for over 30 years. One was an intern and got a new job. Another was found to be watching videos and movies during the job, which isn't great. But they weren't fired because of the cyber attack.
And what has Mayor Andrew Ginther said about the lack of transparency overall, especially from the beginning? I mean, he was one of the people saying that everything was fine. What has he said in hindsight, now that we're a year later?
He goes back really often to that. He goes back really often to that line you mentioned earlier, which is that a lot of cities go through this and the city wants to do better. And the city is going to make investments like the Zero Trust Network. But he's the U.S. Conference of Mayors president, and he has been for a little bit. He knows a lot of these cities, and he really wants to stress to people that this happens to a lot of cities, and Columbus isn't unique in his view.
Is it possible for these type of cyber attacks? They're getting more and more sophisticated. I mean, is even spending $23 million, is it enough? Or we just have to deal with this?
It's a great question. I think it's sort of a wait and see thing. Like Connor suggested, I think there are ways in which hackers could potentially get around Zero Trust Network. This isn't the end all be all to make sure the city is completely protected. And I think the city would agree with that too. There's always going to be threats like this.
Did the city tell you when this end report should be out?
No.
Okay.
The city, the city council has been promising this for a while and wanting a report. It was expected maybe it might come out around the first year, but that didn't happen. And we still don't know when it is going to come out.
And it's been about 1 year since this happened, a year ago in July.
1 year and a couple weeks.
All right. All right. Well, when the report comes out, come back and tell us about it.
I hope so.
Okay. That was WOSU reporter George Shilcock. Thanks for your time, George.
Thank you, Amy.
And coming up, we are going to talk about the privatization of space and the future of NASA. That's when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Space exploration has taken on a markedly different character since the Apollo missions of the 60s and 70s. Years ago, NASA developed and built rockets to propel our astronauts to the stars. Now these production processes have largely been privatized and delegated to companies such as SpaceX. Over the decades, the barons of big business have become increasingly intertwined with politics and space exploration. Now, some experts wonder if the benefits of these partnerships outweigh the potential for fraud and other risks. Joining me now is Eric Berger, senior space editor for Ars Technica. He's also the author of Liftoff, Elon Musk and the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX. Welcome to All Sides, Eric.
Thanks very much, Amy.
So we hear a lot about NASA outsourcing to other companies, SpaceX, Boeing, Blue Origin. But is this happening? Why can't NASA keep things in-house? Why are they having to do this?
Well, they're doing it because it's been a much better deal financially to buy rockets from private companies. The reality is that NASA has launched one rocket in the last 14 years, back in 2022. And SpaceX, just to single them out, has launched, 100 rockets almost this year already. And so the private companies are doing this faster and at far lower cost than the government has traditionally. So NASA could continue to do it, but, it wouldn't have much of a space program if it did everything the traditional way.
Hmm. Are other countries that are exploring space following a similar model? Do other countries privatize too?
So the most, some countries have not really changed much at all, such as Russia, but China is moving quickly toward such a model as well. They have a traditional rocket program where basically the state-owned industries procure and build their own large rockets. But they have been investing heavily in both technology transfer and in talent in a growing space of new space companies for launch and other purposes. And there are dozens of rocket startups in China, some of which are having a lot of success and almost all of which are trying to emulate what SpaceX has done here.
Now, what companies are the primary contractors for the American space program? I mentioned SpaceX, Boeing, and Blue Origin, but is it mostly SpaceX?
So up until about 10 or 15 years ago, it was the traditional companies, the Boeings, Northrops, Lockheeds, and then a combination of Boeing and Lockheed called United Launch Alliance that did almost all of the launches for NASA. In the last 10 years, that's changed a lot. SpaceX is doing a majority of the launching at present because with the Falcon 9, they have really the only rocket that has extra capacity. That's going to change. NASA certainly would like to see more diversity in the future, as well as the U.S. Space Force. And so both arms of the government are trying to support competitors to SpaceX.
Oh, you mentioned Space Force. I hadn't thought about that in a long time. Where are we at with Space Force?
Well, the Space Force budget is now bigger than the budget for NASA, and so they are a major player both in satellites and in launch vehicles. And they currently have an agreement where about half the launches are conducted by SpaceX and half by United Launch Alliance. But actually, their most recent round of contracting, they opened up a new lane for other companies to get in on the action to basically, as I said, really increase the competition in launch.
Hmm. How are these deals between NASA and private contractors structured? You said that it's a good deal for NASA because it's too expensive for NASA to continue doing this. But what other parts of the deal, like what do the private companies gain from NASA?
Right. So I'll just give you like one example. The Europa Clipper mission launched about 18 months ago. And if NASA had launched that on its own rocket, it would have been more than $2 billion. SpaceX launched it on its Falcon Heavy rocket for $150 million. So that's the kind of differences we're talking about potentially in terms of savings. The private companies get assured contracts. Like if you're a launch company, it's a really, really difficult business, Amy, because you're building a very expensive piece of equipment that a single failure can cause everything to go wrong. And so you're really relying on commercial satellite launch contracts. You're relying on and government launch contracts. And so NASA and the Space Force stepping up and committing to buying a certain number of launches from a private company is really the difference between success and failure.
And is that the way it's working? They're committing to a certain number of launches. Is that, you know, they say we'll stick with you for 100 launches or something like that? Is that how they make guarantees?
It's typically not that many launches, but yes, in the case of the Space Force, they'll tell United Launch Alliance we'll buy maybe 24 launches from you over the next 5 years. And to the smaller companies just trying to get going, they'll say if you prove the safety of your rocket over a course of a couple of flights, then you're eligible to bid on future contracts as well.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about all things space and SpaceX and Space Force with Ars Technica's Eric Berger. So does privatizing development of space travel technology save money for the American taxpayer overall, or are we paying these private companies a lot too?
Well, it's really a difficult and thorny question. I think you can say what private space companies are doing right now is enabling NASA to do more, mm-hmm. right? Okay. Our program to return to the moon, Artemis, relies entirely on either SpaceX or Blue Origin to build a lander to take astronauts down to the moon's surface. So it's not, I think many people are probably a little uncomfortable with putting in all of their trust in Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, who founded SpaceX and Blue Origin. But the reality is that NASA did not have the funding to do it any other way at this point. So, you know, it's good for the private companies, but it's also good for the government. But it's a little uncomfortable because, like, the future of space exploration, in some sense, is in the hands of billionaires who, as we've seen with Elon Musk over the last several months, can act pretty capriciously.
Yeah. Elon Musk and the other billionaires that you mentioned funding spaceflight, they've gotten very involved in America's political process over the past year. Where does the conflict of interest lie for space company executives being involved with politics and government when it comes to government contracts? Is there a check and balance anywhere?
Well, there are massive conflicts of interest, especially when Elon was kind of at the center of the U.S. government. He's mm-hmm. much more on the outside now, so he has, I think, a little bit less influence on how things are done. But the reality is, you know, that there's always been massive conflicts of interest. You know, back in decades previously, there was a rotating door that, you know, officials would come work at NASA for several years and then go into private industry at a Boeing or a Lockheed and really kind of, you know, they would steer policy and then go work for the companies that benefited from those contracts. And of course, the Boeings and Lockheeds and other traditional contractors had very powerful lobbying arms. It's not like there was this really massive arm's length difference before, and certainly with Congress you've seen the writing of contracts that really benefit some companies over others. So it's different, right, in the sense that you've got a few totemic figures that are out there both benefiting from this and also helping the government. But you know, I think that there's always been a, you know, pretty cozy relationship, I would say, between contractors and, you know, NASA in the past.
What about NASA's funding right now? It's been tied up in different parts of the budget process. There were worries about big cuts and staff reductions. So what's the latest there? Does NASA have a budget?
NASA has a budget for the next few months until we get to October 1st, and then we'll see what happens. It's a very difficult time at the space agency. The White House wants to cut the space agency's budget by 25%. They want to basically slash science by 50% and really essentially, you know, cut off the future of science programs at NASA. Would be very debilitating. At the same time, Congress has stepped up and said, you know, we're not going to stand for these cuts. So that's hopeful if you're a NASA employee, but at the same time, like, they've had significant workforce reductions. About 3,000 or 3,500 of the 19,000 agency civil servants have left with buyouts and other incentives from the Trump administration. So it's a time of significant change, and it's worrisome to me, as someone who's followed NASA, loved NASA for 25 years, to have this really uncertain future and not a particularly clear mission. Because yes, while Congress is going to restore funding, a lot of their priorities are not necessarily in the best interests of NASA's overall exploration program.
That, I guess that was my next question. I was going to ask you, what is the mission of NASA? Is it to go to the moon, to go to Mars? Like, what are they working on?
Well, they have been working on the Artemis program to go back to the moon. And that kind of is going to remain part of the agency's mission. The president talked about sending humans to Mars. Sean Duffy, who's the interim or the acting administrator of NASA, he's also the Secretary of Transportation, so he's pretty busy, has also talked about going to Mars. But right now that's a lot of talk. And so I think that you know, they're trying to cobble together some plan that gets them to the moon by or before China gets there around 2030. And they're trying to think about something that they can do on the moon in the 2030s around the South Pole that's meaningful and sustainable. But I wouldn't say that they've found those answers yet.
What about other parts of NASA, which involves, you know, launching satellites and maintaining the space station and things like that? Do they still have the funding for all of those projects?
They do, but the space station is aging. It's almost 3 decades old, and it's slated to be deorbited in 2030. And there's a big debate right now about what's going to replace that, whether we're going to continue to have a presence with astronauts in low Earth orbit as we have had since 1998. And actually, I was just looking at a directive that came out from the Office of NASA yesterday that sort of scrambles that whole process for these commercial space stations. And so I would say that that's in a pretty difficult spot. And we also talked about the science programs. You know, the Congress has restored funding for a lot of them, but if there's a continuing resolution or a government shutdown, the White House has put plans in place to shut down a lot of these observatories in space if they get the opportunity to do so.
And you mentioned earlier, you know, the shrinking of NASA, partially due to DOGE cuts, also to people just leaving for taking buyouts. You said about 3,000 of 19,000 employees left. Those 3,000, were they in any particular program that shut down, or is it across the board?
It was really much across the board. It was people taking early retirement. It was, you know, younger people, talented people who had better options in the commercial space industry and decided to take them. So it was across the board.
Given the recent splintering in partnerships between Elon Musk and Donald Trump, you know, their relationship is not what it used to be. Do you think that NASA's relationship with SpaceX will change at all?
This is a great question. I think the one thing we can be pretty confident in is that both the Space Force and NASA have been told by White House officials to try to find alternatives to the services that SpaceX provides for launch, for in-space transportation, for satellite connectivity. The problem for those is that right now SpaceX offers the best prices and the best services for a lot of different areas of space transportation. Like we have no way to get our astronauts to and from the space station without SpaceX. SpaceX is launching, you know, a majority of the national security satellites at present. It provides, you know, satellite communication through Starlink and military version of that cannot be replicated in any meaningful way. So it's a heavy lift for other companies to sort of compete.
Your most recent story that you wrote covered a high-level meeting between NASA and the new head of Russia's space agency. The director general, is it Dmitry Bakunov recently visited Florida for a launch of the Crew 11 mission. Can you talk, why was this a notable visit? Tell me more about this NASA-Russia thing.
Well, you know, NASA and Russia, after the Cold War, or even amid the Cold War, were kind of one of the first areas where the United States and the Soviet Union started working together. And so there's this almost 50-year history of partnership between the United States and Russia in space. Mm-hmm. That was severely debilitated after the Ukraine invasion a few years ago. And so there's been really strained relations. And so the head of NASA had not met with the head of Roscosmos, which is the main Russian space corporation, state-backed, had not met in nearly 8 years. And so they had their first, so it's Sean Duffy, who's, again, the acting administrator, met with Bakunov in Florida and in Houston as well. And they've had high-level discussions about, you know, it had been widely assumed that once the space station program ended, the U.S. and Russian cooperation would end as well. But I think there's now a pathway for some kind of partnership in the future.
Do we need to partner with them? I guess. Yeah. Why?
We really don't. in the sense that their program has been in a long, slow decline for decades just because they haven't invested in the program and their various initiatives. They still have some pretty innovative military space stuff, but on the civil side, the space stations, things like that, the amount of money they put into it's gone down, and the war in Ukraine has siphoned away a lot of resources for that. One of the main reasons why we partnered with Russia decades ago was to keep their rocket scientists employed on the civil side of things and not to go off and build missiles for Iran or other places like that. There probably still is some interest in engagement, with regard to that. But again, sort of the hostilities in Ukraine and that seemingly unending war probably puts a damper on some of that. So it remains to be seen. But for diplomatic purposes, there may be some kind of agreement going forward.
So this visit to Florida for the launch of Crew 11, it was called the Crew 11 mission. What is this mission? What are they doing?
Well, that was just SpaceX's 11th crew flight to the ISS. They're carrying four astronauts up and bringing four back. And a Russian flies on every one of these missions, and an American flies on the Russian crew missions to the space station. And so Bakunov was there because there was a Russian cosmonaut, and also it felt kind of like a charm offensive to me, where Russia was really seeking to re-engage with the United States on space flight activities. And not clear to me entirely what it all means yet, but it's definitely a change in the tone and tenor of the relationship than we've seen from over the last 5 years.
Also, could you tell me about, I don't have your latest story in front of me, but I know it mentioned a Dream Chaser space plane. Can you tell me what that is? Tell me about that.
Right. So 10 years ago, NASA picked two companies to build spacecraft that would replace the space shuttle in terms of crew transportation. And SpaceX has been successful with Dragon. That's the Crew 11 launch we just spoke about. And Boeing has been working on a Starliner spacecraft, which has had more difficulties. The third company was Sierra, which had a Dream Chaser spacecraft. And this vehicle looked a little bit like a small version of NASA's space shuttle. It wasn't picked, but a couple of years later, NASA chose it to do cargo delivery services to the space station. But it's been 8 years, almost 9 years since then, and Sierra's had some really difficult challenges with getting that vehicle ready for space. And so my story basically said that launch, the first launch of Dream Chaser, was very unlikely to happen this year. And instead of flying all the way to the space station, it may just kind of fly nearby and not berth. Because of the propulsion system issues they're still having.
Well, as someone who has covered NASA and space for a long time, what will you be looking for in the coming months when it comes to the future of NASA? What will be an indicator for you that, like, we will continue going to the moon, that the administration might be interested in Mars? Like, what needs to be happening in the short term to indicate that there is a long term?
So the big thing that's going to happen in the next 6 months is there's going to be a lot of light and noise about the Artemis II mission, which is likely to launch around February of next year. And that's sending four astronauts around the moon. And you can expect the administration to say that they're advancing the schedule of this mission. And this proves that they're on a pathway to the moon and Mars. And some of that is true, but I expect them to really overstate the case. The reality is that there is a lot of work that needs to be done on a lunar lander and on spacesuits to make lunar missions happen. And I'm going to be looking to see progress on those efforts, as opposed to what happens with Artemis II, which by all appearances should be a big success.
Okay. So we can't just go back to what we used in the 60s and 70s and be like, let's just use that again.
Well,
Am I oversimplifying it?
no, you're not. I mean, it's a great question. Like, the lunar module worked. Like, we did six successful landings and it got two people down. The problem was it was just two people and it was a short period of time, and NASA would like to move toward a more reusable, affordable system that would allow for longer landings of more people and allow us to bring more stuff back from the moon to Earth. And so the lunar module would be kind of recreating what we did 50 years ago, but it was kind of a dead end technology. You really couldn't expand it, and so you would like to have something better, right? A Model T car could get you from, it could drive you across the state of Massachusetts, but you'd probably wouldn't choose that solution today if you were taking a cross-country trip.
Point taken. Okay, I get it. That's a good analogy with the car. Well, we have been talking about space with Eric Berger, senior space editor for Ars Technica. Thank you for joining us today, Eric.
My pleasure, Amy. Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk about some changes at YouTube. That is when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. YouTube is going to start estimating the age of its users based on content watched and other factors. This leads many users to wonder what would happen if an adult gets tagged as a child. Where might we see this technology next? And are we inching closer to the phrase, is this a little too far for AI threshold? Joining us now is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So YouTube wants to estimate the age of a user and then react accordingly. How would this estimator work? How would it figure out how old I am?
That is such a great question, and YouTube is not going to tell us. The reason is the build a better mousetrap fallacy. As soon as they tell us how it works, then there will be ways to subvert it. What we do know is that YouTube has tried and frankly failed over the last 10 years to come up with ways to stop kids from seeing content on YouTube that they shouldn't be watching. Mm-hmm. There is an effort to make a separate version of YouTube called YouTube Kids that was supposed to be age-gated to things that were acceptable to folks who were under age 13, only to find that there were paths in which people were watching things on YouTube Kids and making their way to regular YouTube videos that shouldn't have been a part of that app. There have been content restrictions put in place by Android phones where adults can say this information is age gated to anyone who's using this particular profile when they log in, so they can only see that kind of stuff. That ended up not working the way that YouTube had intended, and kids were getting access to content that was older than them. So this approach in coordination with the online safety organization Enough is Enough is an effort to observe behavior and use that behavior on YouTube to determine whether an age gate should be put in place.
Hmm. So is it mostly for protecting kids from adult content? What about the other direction? What if I like to watch obnoxious cartoons and silly unboxing videos, but I'm actually in my mid-40s? Is it going to, YouTube would think I'm a 10-year-old boy?
So the behavior is likely going to be a bit more prescriptive than just what it is you're watching. Mm. This includes how long you're watching, whether you're on a live stream for 10 hours, for example, and just watching, kind of the same thing over and over again, the kind of comments that you would leave. And this includes, age relevant grammar and spelling, that would come from comments and similar behavior. The kinds of groups that videos are shared to is possibly also the kind of information that would be made available. Any behavior that can be tracked in one way or another on YouTube specifically, whether or not you're logged in, would create one of these age gates. And so the challenge there, as you pointed out, is if an adult is mimicking these behaviors and it has found themselves age gated, getting out of it is going to require sending proof of identity directly to YouTube. This could include a photo of your driver's license or state ID, as well as some additional verification information in order to have your account released from this age lock.
Is there a way to opt out of the program, or is everyone who goes to YouTube going to be in on this?
For the moment, this is a test for what YouTube describes as a small subset of daily users with no immediate plan for how it would scale to the entirety of YouTube's massive audience. But one assumes that if this ends up being successful, that before this time next year, it's possible that this could just be the norm for how YouTube operates.
Does this have anything to do with recent MasterCard and Visa restrictions that have caused Spotify to set up stricter restrictions? Is it related?
I think it's a little more closely related to some EU guidelines for how kids are able to access online content than credit card purchases. YouTube doesn't see itself a ton in the way of transactions directly on YouTube. It is a function that exists in some way when you're donating to a follower that or to a creator that you enjoy. But there are limits to how that platform works. I think, in a lot of places that are not the United States, there is an increased focus on what information kids have access to on a daily basis. And YouTube has a choice between either, playing along, on a global scale or, starting to accept that YouTube will just behave differently in different countries.
Okay. So, tell me more about what the EU is doing. So the EU making them do this, and so they're going to do it in America as well?
In a way, this is an extension of the EU GDPR policy, where, there's just a certain amount of data that can't be, tracked when it comes to certain people. There's a weird kind of line that has to be split there between being able to track that information and not track the person responsible for it. So this kind of age limitation makes it so that YouTube is no longer tracking the individual traffic of a person that has logged in and is clicking on specific things. By guessing a specific age, it allows them to create these age gates in a way that doesn't require age verification at the point of account creation.
Now, what if you're a conspiracy theorist and say that you're not protecting kids, you're just trying to have more surveillance on people and know more about, get more identity information?
I think that that's always a reasonable argument to be made. As soon as somebody says, in order to prove that you're a person on the internet, you have to send me a copy of your photo ID. That's not a sentence that I think most people are comfortable with on a daily basis. But I also think that YouTube as a whole is just broadly not a safe place for kids. And so, understanding the complexity that goes into that and how long YouTube as a company has been trying not particularly successfully to solve this problem without incurring the wrath of those who would call, this a surveillance state, at some point a decision has to be made that we're either okay with protecting children or we're okay with not.
Yeah, I mean, even from my perspective, I wouldn't let my kids get TikTok, but I let them get YouTube, and now maybe I regret that, right?
There are always limitations that can be put in place, and YouTube, if you are logged in, will show a parent a record of what has been watched.
I know, and you can hide a subscriber, and then your kid asks you where it went, and you're like, I don't know.
But also, kids are very clever and almost entirely digital natives and know how to access YouTube in ways that you probably have not even thought of.
Indeed. Exactly. Yes. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Russell Holley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Let's move away from me being scared of YouTube to Uber Eats. So Uber Eats has unveiled a new program that allows users to upload photos and suggestions about restaurants to Uber Eats. And it's all powered by AI, of course, as everything is. So what's the goal here? Is it to make restaurants more appealing for customers?
Yes. So Uber Eats was actually one of the first companies to make it so that you could take a picture of the food that you got and share it. And that would be in place of the menu listing. So you could see that the chicken wings from the place down the street look like this because a person took this picture and it wasn't just the store, taking a super high quality version of that photo and presenting it in a way that, the picture of the burger at McDonald's never looks like the one that you get in the box when you open it, right? Because, that's how that works. So this was a way to, keep some of these companies honest. And show what the food looks like when it arrives. It turns out that this is actually really bad for business, and there are quite a few restaurants who saw a significant downturn in sales when this happened. So Uber is working with an AI company to take the image that you have taken and make it look artificially nice by putting that food on a nice plate and giving it a neutral background and making, you know, the serving look a great deal more appetizing than what it is that you got in your box.
So is the point here to benefit the restaurant now rather than the actual, like, having a review? I feel like this is like a backwards Yelp. I don't know what it is.
Right. No, I think that this is an effort to split the difference. I think that, you know, the average person is not a photographer. Mm-hmm. And so it's not hard to take a picture of even very nice food that looks not particularly appetizing. You know, and so, you know, holding a company responsible just because I took a picture in a dark hallway of a thing and thought it was really great and submitted it to Uber Eats isn't really, you know, what the company is after. And so in a way, I think that this is an effort to, you know, they're still showing the food that you have taken the picture of. It's just the environment around it is much nicer. And whether or not that is, deliberately misleading or dishonest, I think is going to depend on how much work Uber Eats actually ends up putting into making these pictures look more appetizing than they are, which is something that's only going to bear out with time.
Yeah. What about DoorDash or Grubhub? Are they doing something like this? Or is this Uber Eats all by itself?
This is going to start with Uber Eats, but it's going to roll out pretty quickly, I suspect, to a lot of the other companies. The, you know, being able to see what the food is on the menu is something that all of these companies are trying to find solutions to, because in most cases, if the restaurant hasn't provided the pictures themselves, then it's just a description of the product. Which is also, you know, not great. We are, you know, a lot of folks, you know, kind of visual eaters, especially when we're trying to get something through an app and have it delivered quickly.
Is this a way to get more? I mean, what if the restaurants just upload the pictures? You know, if they don't like what their customers are posting, they could just do it themselves.
And they should, but in a lot of cases, they don't, you know, and that's, you know, the restaurants, you know, they're usually quite focused on making the food and not always interested in marketing, especially when you're dealing with ghost kitchens.
Yeah.
You know, you can look on Uber Eats. There is, you know, there's a single restaurant that that holds, you know, 9 or 10 different restaurants in it now for things that you would order from Uber Eats. And maintaining that is just a little more difficult than it used to be because of the additional marketing that goes into that and the expense incurred there. And it could certainly be argued that if you are going to open a ghost kitchen and run that, then you should be responsible for, you know, making it as appetizing as possible. But I think Uber Eats is, you know, their immediate focus here is to increase orders, you know, at any cost.
Right. That makes me just, who's the customer here? The food eater or the food maker?
Yes.
All right. So moving on to our third topic, CNET recently ranked some of the best sleep headphones on the market. What was the best collective one between all your judges who came up with your list? What's the best pair of sleep headphones we can wear?
Yeah, so sleep ear headphones are, you know, they're just as complicated as normal earbuds. Is that not everybody likes to have a thing inside their ear, certainly not while they're asleep. But there are a lot of folks who enjoy the idea of having background noise or the Calm app or something like that when they sleep. So instead of finding one that is, you know, kind of the absolute best for every single person, you know, there's quite a range depending on how it is that you enjoy having things in, you know, in your, if you are the kind of person who's okay with having earbuds that go in your ear while you sleep. There's a company called Ozlo, O-Z-L-O, that makes these things called sleep buds. They are extremely high quality. They do a lot of noise cancellation. So if you live in an area that's got quite a bit of noise, it's actively filtering those things out. The battery lasts for at least 12 hours on a single charge, so you can sleep and not worry about them turning off. This is especially useful if you are on like a long flight and are trying to sleep on that flight. But they are $350, which is not something everyone's going to sign up for, especially since you're not likely to want to wear these during the day for a couple of different reasons. But there are also something that's quite a bit more popular, I think, for folks who don't enjoy having those headphones in their ears, in these sleep masks, where they're padded masks that have eye coverings, but then the headband part goes over your ears, where there are a set of small speakers that deliver really pleasing sound in order to help you sleep. The best one of those that we've tested is made by a company called Manta. And their sleep mask is designed to kind of distribute all of the wiring and stuff so that you don't have to worry about accidentally turning the wrong way and resting on a battery, or having the headphones press against your ear. And those are right around $150.
So our listeners can go to CNET and just type in best sleep headphones, and you'll see the list of all of them. There's pictures of all of them. There's prices. But do the earbuds that you guys ranked higher, will they stay in your ears? Because that's what I have the problem with, where they fall out, and then in the morning I'm on the hunt for my missing earbud.
That is part of the problem. And when you're talking about fitness style earbuds, they have like a wedge style design that will use pressure to keep them in your ears, but that's not something that's really comfortable to sleep with. So what Oslo has done is they've kind of created a different version of that wedge design. So that's really, really soft material, and it pushes kind of in both directions instead of just applying pressure in one way. In a lot of the tests that we had done, kind of rolling around constantly trying to get them to come out, they stayed in quite a bit better than any of the other ones that we tested.
We only have a minute left, but also, I don't want a thing wrapped around my head, canceling out all of life, because then I'm afraid I'm not going to hear my kids calling for me if they need me. Have you tested any with just one ear so you could be like have both the best of both worlds?
Yes, you do run into some problems if you just decide to use one of these and that you lose like some of the noise cancellation things, which obviously is a thing that you would prefer for someone to be able to get your attention, but they do still very much work if your goal is to just have something from kind of background noise or a call map or something to help you fall asleep and stay asleep.
All right, well, thank you for your time. That is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks, Russell.
Thank you for having me.
And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.